Hello and welcome. You're listening to the first ever edition of What's That Topic? And today I'm joined by the wonderful Rebecca Lyons. How are you today, Bex?
Hi, Georgie. Yeah, I was going to say, please call me Bex. It sounds so formal. I'm fine. How are you?
I'm very good, thank you.
Good.
Yes, glad the essays are all over.
Oh, well, only a matter of time until the next lot starts.
So. Yeah, thank you for that.
Keep you grounded.
So the reason I've got Bex here today is because she specialises in Arthurian literature, and I'm interested in Arthurian literature myself, so I thought we could have a little discussion.
Okay.
So one question I was really interested in, especially during my A-levels when I did a project on this, was how Arthurian literature has sort of changed over time and why it's lasted so long.
Yeah, well, I think Arthurian literature is just, well, and the Arthurian legends more generally, are such a kind of grounded part of British culture and memory and history and literature, and I think you'd be hard pressed even in this digital age to find someone who doesn't know about King Arthur. And you know, why is that? Well, looking back, if we're trying to find a kind of historical Arthur, he would be in the time after the Romans left Britain, so around 410 AD. The Romans left because there was a lot of trouble in Rome. It was being sacked by Visigoths. So as you do, you go home and try and protect your homeland. So in the wake of that, Britain was kind of undefended, and then was prey to anyone who wanted to have a go, basically. So you get, you know, the Anglo-Saxons, the Picts, the Danes all coming over trying to get a piece of this kind of fertile land. And it's hard to think now, after we've had the huge kind of Victorian Empire, of Britain as this little island over kind of the edge of nowhere, because they didn't really know what was beyond it, apart from Ireland, you know, back in the early Middle Ages. So it's kind of at the very edge of the Roman Empire, but very fertile, so very in demand. And really, yeah, the historical basis for any kind of Arthur comes at this time after the Romans have left. So what you get is, for instance, the 6th century historian / monk Gildas talks about this guy called Ambrosius Aurelianus, who is a Romano-Briton, and he stays in Britain. And he basically bands together the native Britons to fight against the Anglo-Saxons and kind of be a united force. And then he gets conflated with someone called Arthur. So we've got, again, with its basis in the 6th century, we get a poem called Y Gododin, which is a Welsh poem. And it talks about these peoples, the Gododin peoples, who came from around the Edinburgh region today. And this poem talks about a battle against the Anglo-Saxons, and it says, blah, 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 tells of all these exploits of all these different warriors, and of one particular warrior it says, you know, and he fed the ravens with the carcasses of his victims, but he was no Arthur. And that's the only mention of Arthur that we get in this poem. But you can tell that even around the 6th century, someone called Arthur is in the kind of cultural presence.
Wow.
Yeah, so, but then, and it kind of spirals on from that. So from this very, very tiny potential grain of truth, he might not have even been a real person, we then get, you know, layers and layers built upon this tiny aspect, which may potentially have been fact.
Oh, that's really amazing, because I always wonder how you just come from such a small, small thing and how it's just expanded so much over time. I mean, why do you think people are so fixated on Arthur, just on from this tiny, tiny, tiny fact, if it is a fact, to have just come into this huge legend? I mean, we go up to Geoffrey of Monmouth and things like that. I mean, is there a reason why he suddenly picked up this story?
Yeah, so, I mean, for any of your listeners who aren't aware of who Geoffrey of Monmouth is, he's also a religious character like Gildas, who's writing, he writes his history in 1136. So this is after the Normans have conquered England, and potentially the Normans are interested in, you know, the heritage of this land that they've conquered. Mm-hmm. And what we see with Geoffrey of Monmouth is he writes the history of the kings of Britain, and in that he includes Arthur, and he talks about some of his battles and conquests. And I mean, he doesn't add anything like what we would think would be to do with the Arthurian legends today. For instance, Guinevere is not mentioned, I don't think. No. And, you know, the romantic aspects come later. But the kernel is there and it's starting to become kind of more romanticised. And Geoffrey, again, is weaving more and more into this legend. And I think the reason that Arthur has really prevailed right through from the early Middle Ages to now, I think it's a few things. I think the fact that he's not necessarily a real historical character means that subsequent authors, you know, film writers, artists have felt free to kind of embellish and make the stories, make the legend their own. But I think also he is essentially a hero in a really, really dark time. So against all these invading forces, if we're looking back at post-Roman Britain, there's one man who kind of shines a light. And we've always been interested in heroes. I mean, look at Batman now. He's kind of, you know, medieval Batman.
I think that's the best comparison of King Arthur I've ever heard. And would you also say that King Arthur's a bit of a Christ-like figure? Because, I mean, at the end of a lot of the versions of the legend, there's this sense that he's going to come again. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, potentially, I think he's been conflated with a lot of myths and a lot of kind of, you know, potentially Celtic deities as well. But yeah, definitely in a Christian era, which, you know, we find ourselves in, in the Middle Ages, particularly when, it's very Christian, I think they did draw parallels with Jesus and Arthur. And again, I think that's another reason that the legend has endured, because the fact that he's not necessarily dead, you know, he could come back at any time in our moment of greatest need. I think that's a really kind of seductive idea.
In a way he does, doesn't he? I mean, he's constantly adapted and sort of constantly here.
Yeah, no, precisely. And it carries on right through after Geoffrey of Monmouth. Obviously, we get the French really pick him up. They love Arthur, you know, and they create Lancelot,
who's
kind of the ideal knight. And Guinevere comes into it and the Round Table. And then we get the much more recognisable Arthur that we might think of today. And then it comes back across the channel to England. And in the 15th century, we get Thomas Malory's masterpiece, The More to Arthur, which really, for the first time in the English language, I mean, it's written in Middle English, it really, for the first time, ties together a lot of these ideas and really brings it into a kind of coherent whole. It's worth reading. I'd recommend it. It's my favourite book.
I've already read it.
Good. Well, I hope so, because we taught it last
time. Yes, I was going to say. I think a lot of English students will be familiar with that one.
Yeah, good.
Oh, brilliant. What would you say is your favourite text then of Arthur? Would you say it was The More to Arthur?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, it is a huge read, as you know.
Yes, as I do know.
But he really, I mean, Sir Thomas Malory as well, I find such an intriguing character because, okay, so he's this Warwickshire gentry knight, but he's going off and kind of kidnapping people's wives and stealing church silver, and he's imprisoned several times and he manages to escape prison and swim across the River Fleet, I think.
Goodness me.
He's really, I mean, he's such a complex and interesting character from what we know. I mean, we know very little, really. It comes from historical records. And they're quite scant about him, and his identity, you know, wasn't really clear until fairly recently. And he wrote this whole masterpiece, which really brings together the French tradition, the English tradition of Arthur, and, you know, so many facets. He wrote it in prison, which just I find remarkable. There's so much complexity there. And he really, really builds upon the character of Lancelot. And you can see that, you know, perhaps he sees Lancelot as the idealised version of himself, you know, this knight that maybe Sir Thomas Malory didn't quite match up to but wished he did.
Oh, in the same way that Lancelot almost wishes he lived up to Galahad.
Yeah, perhaps, his own son. Yeah, a bit of rivalry there. And then that Guinevere gets in the way.
And would you say then that Sir Thomas Malory's version was the first real piece of literature about Arthur that sort of developed this legend into the romantic, rather than, I think, when we read Geoffrey of Monmouth, it feels a bit more historical, even though whether it's true fact is very much up to debate. But
yeah, so Geoffrey of Monmouth is very much writing the chronicle tradition, which is, as you say, a kind of historical genre in the Middle Ages. But so he writes in, I think it's 1136, but then in the 1170s we get Chrétien de Troyes, who's a French writer who picks up a lot of the Arthurian stories in French and really romanticizes them then. So the kind of romance aspects of Arthurian literature start in the 12th century, but it's really Malory who brings them into English, because I mean, we get alliterative Arthurian poetry before Malory, but it doesn't really have the romance aspects that we would think of them now. It's kind of more in the chronicle tradition. So thanks to Malory for that. And then of course we get TV series and films and
would you say it's a bit more fantastical today with all these film and TV adaptations?
Yeah, possibly. And I think possibly the reason for that is that, you know, we have special effects that are so developed. So again, filmmakers are feeling quite free to explore, you know. My guilty pleasure was the TV series Merlin.
I will confess that I did love that show.
Yeah, I think you find a lot of Arthurian scholars who really enjoyed it, perhaps against the odds. And that's quite fantastical. But then at the other end of the spectrum, you have that god-awful film with Clive Owen and Keira Knightley.
Oh, yeah.
From 2004, I think, King Arthur. And that kind of tries to go back to this kind of Dux Bellorum, which means battle leader, kind of idea of King Arthur in kind of early medieval post-Roman Britain. So, I mean, you still have filmmakers going back to this idea of a historical Arthur. But really, again, I think he's a hero for all ages and all places and all times, and you can do what you want with him, and that's the beauty of him.
Okay, so Arthurian legend is your specialist topic at the moment, isn't it?
That's right.
So what are you researching specifically?
Well, I'm currently undertaking a PhD, and it was at the University of York, as you know, because that's how I know you. But actually, my supervisor has just transferred to Bristol, and she's poached me from York. I've gone with her, technically.
Oh, no.
But I'm staying in York, as you'll be relieved to hear.
Yes.
So I look at Arthurian literature in the 15th century owned by women, because we have quite a strong idea of what men were doing in terms of reading and absorbing and kind of reworking and thinking about Arthurian literature and its themes in their own lives. So we have men going off to joust and kind of modelling themselves on Lancelot, and even wearing clothes that have kind of Arthurian aspects embroidered into them. And we really don't have as much of an idea as with what women were doing with the texts, you know, how they were kind of reacting to them, because obviously there's a lot for men in the Arthurian legends. You've got heroes and battles and I mean men in the Middle Ages, you know.
Yeah. Maybe not so much now.
But for women, I mean, there potentially aren't as many kind of role models. We have Guinevere, the adulterous wife and queen of King Arthur, who has affairs with Lancelot. We have Morgan le Fay, who's Arthur's half-sister and is kind of constantly battling against him in one way or another, trying to thwart his plans. So it's really interesting to me to try and figure out how women read these texts and how they kind of incorporated them into their own lives, perhaps. So that's what I'm looking at.
It's very interesting, because I agree. I think women in Arthurian texts are just, well, usually the damsel in distress, aren't they? Or, you know, the Lady of Shalott killing herself over love for Lancelot. It's all a bit tragic, really, isn't it?
Well, I mean, yes, we do definitely have those damsels in distress. But Morgan and Guinevere are very feisty women. I think they're fantastic. And I have to say, on a personal note, I kind of see a lot of Guinevere in myself. She's a very sort of capricious, high maintenance woman. And yes, I feel like quite a lot of women, myself included, might, you know, kind of respond to that. But no, I mean, you have some really powerful women, such as Morgan le Fay and she's always hanging around with these women that are called the Four Queens, and they have some kind of magical powers as well, and they're always keeping knights on their toes. And I kind of think, well, if there was no Morgan Le Fay to challenge Arthur in times of peace, then, you know, how would he and his knights keep their skills updated and, you know, practice? So I think she's not necessarily a bad thing for them.
Oh, brilliant. Yeah, that's interesting, actually. I've never really thought about women in Arthurian legends. So
if you have nothing to fight against, then you have no way to prove yourself. And I think Morgan provides that kind of outlet.
So, yeah, that's interesting. It sounds like it's going to be a good PhD.
Oh, I hope so.
How long have you been doing a PhD now?
Well, I started in January 2013, so I'm just going into my third year now.
Okay.
Yeah.
So getting busy.
Serious.
Yeah.
But it's fine.
Yeah, it's all good. You seem in a good place with it, so that's good. I know my brother's girlfriend is currently doing a PhD in Oxford Brookes and is about the same stage.
How's she coping?
She's okay. She's a warrior, but yeah, she's powering through. I know it can get quite stressful.
Yeah, but. Well, I think the thing is that I worked full time before I started my PhD, and frankly, doing a PhD is wonderful compared to working full time in a job that you don't necessarily enjoy that much. Mm.
What were you working as?
Oh, well, I took quite an unconventional route to my PhD. So I took a gap year where I travelled to Borneo and learned to scuba dive and, you know, all those fun things that you do in your gap year. And then I started my undergrad in English literature in 2005, finished in 2008. And then a month after I graduated, I was fortunate enough to land a job in publishing, which is kind of every English graduate's dream.
Yeah.
So, and even better, I was an editorial assistant on the Arden Shakespeare, which, you know, was just fantastic.
Mm.
And from there, I kind of worked my way up in the world of publishing, became an editor, started to move more into digital products and books because I love books. I love reading them. I love owning them. But making them can be a bit of a pain.
Yeah.
And authors can be prima donnas, especially, you know, when they're scholars and they're busy teaching and, you know, doing their own research. But yeah, digital stuff, web stuff is kind of a lot easier and more fun in many ways. So I became a web editor.
Wow.
And yeah.
So do you think you'd ever want to go back into editing, or if you've done it and finished with it?
I don't know. See, the sad thing was that the Arden Shakespeare got sold to Bloomsbury whilst I was working on it. So I stayed at the publishing house that I was at and kind of took up other duties. And I was working on books like hair and beauty therapy textbooks.
Oh,
and
no.
I know your listeners can't see me, but Georgie, I'm not wearing a scrap of makeup, am I? I'm just kind of not really.
No, that doesn't sound as interesting.
Not really me.
No, when you've just done an English literature degree as well, it's not really the kind of work that you want to be looking at.
Yeah, so I think, I mean, I did my master's part-time whilst I worked full-time in publishing. And then I decided to do my PhD full time and quit my career in publishing, you know, my glittering career. And everyone said I was insane and what are you doing? But I decided that really to straddle two worlds that are so demanding, publishing and academia, I really couldn't give 100% to either of them. And I felt drained and I had no time for a social life or, you know, anything. So I decided to devote myself to this dream of studying Arthurian literature and women and books. And frankly, I love it. And I've been teaching, as you know, because I taught you last term.
You did indeed.
And it's just really opened my eyes to so many possibilities. And I really feel like having done this PhD, nearly having done it, it's opened the doors to so many new things that I hadn't considered before, like teaching, like potentially working in academia, or potentially going back into publishing but working on books that I'm more interested in on a personal level, like medieval literature. You know, so there's a lot of possibilities.
Yeah, definitely. So just quickly going back to your master's whilst you were working, how did you balance everything. I mean, full-time and a part-time master's is kind of sounds kind of mad, but
yeah, well, it really was. It's one of those things where you look back and you're not quite sure how you did it, but you got through it somehow. And actually, I have to say that doing a master's part-time was a really good thing for me, because I saw people who were doing them full-time, and it's quite intense to do all of the work that you have to do for a master's over the space of 1 year, as well as, you know, if potentially you want to go on and do a PhD, you have to be thinking about applications and kind of putting together some kind of PhD proposal slap bang in the middle of your master's, which is all kind of really frantic. And yeah, for me, doing it over the space of 2 years gave me a lot more time to process and absorb what I'd been doing, and then think a bit more deeply about how I wanted to move forward and do a PhD. So I would recommend doing a master's over 2 years. Maybe don't work full time.
Maybe part time work, part time master's might be a bit more feasible.
I was also self-funded, so working full time really helped with that, because, you know, it gave me money. But how did I get through it? I think coffee, very understanding friends and family, and just self-motivation. You have to be motivated, otherwise it won't work.
It's good. Your dedication shows that you love what you do, which is inspiring.
I do.
Yeah. And also going back to financially then, is what's it like doing a master's? Because at the moment, I know that myself and a lot of students heavily depend on the student finance system. Could you immediately go into your master's after university? Did you have to save up a lot before starting?
So I finished my undergrad in 2008 and I started my master's in 2010. So yeah, I worked for a few years. I think as well because I wanted to make sure that doing a master's was what I really wanted to do, and that I wasn't just carrying on the path of academia because I wasn't sure, you know, because, you know, there was nothing else to do.
Yeah.
So when I came back to it after a 2 year break, like you say, it was because I really, really wanted it and I had that dedication. And like you, I depended upon student finances for my undergrad. You know, I got a student loan, which I'm still paying off and probably will be forever. But it was a lot cheaper in my day, obviously.
Yes.
But I mean, in the grand scheme of things, I don't think masters are too expensive. Maybe that's a controversial thing to say, but I definitely think for me it was worth it.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's good to know then.
Yeah. And it's fun. And, you know, if you do it full time, it's only a year, and it's a year to make sure that you know what you're doing and you're on the right path. And some people find when they do a master's that actually they hate academia and they want to leave it and they've had enough. Some people, like me, are glutton for punishment and return for more. So, yeah.
Okay, that's interesting, because I've always thought about taking one and never really been 100% sure if it's the right way to go, but I've still got time, so
take a few years out. Yeah. You know, go and see the world. I think, who was it? St. Augustine said that the world is a book and those who don't travel only read a page. And I think that's really true. You know, go and experience things.
Yeah.
She says, being an old woman.
No, not at all. And also, how did you go into the working world from your undergrad degree? You say you got a job after a month?
Yeah.
That's very good. How did you do that, please?
I applied my little tush off to pretty much everything. Also, I mean, this isn't going to help you very much, but it was August 2008, and I think the credit crunch and the recession really hit in September 2008. So people who I'd graduated with said, oh, I'm burnt out, I'm going to take 6 months and go to India and find myself. And then they came back and there were no jobs, and, you know, they were working in Debenhams and doing whatever they could to make money. And I think really it was kind of lucky timing, which doesn't help you too much. Sorry, Georgie. But I've never had trouble getting a job. And I do think that if you challenge yourself, if you do lots of extracurricular things like you are with this radio show, you know, build up your CV. You have to be really mindful that the world is so competitive. You're going to be against your kind of Oxbridge graduates with a first from Cambridge and, you know, having done all these things. So you really have to figure out how to market yourself as best you can. Draw on your strengths. You know, for me, I'm a web editor, so I've kept up my freelance web editing whilst I've been doing my PhD. And it's important to make sure you've got a lot of strings to your bow. You know, don't just think that having a degree will guarantee you a job, because it really won't. But, you know, do everything and put it all on your CV and make sure it's a really, really impressive document. And that's the best advice I can give you, I think.
That's brilliant advice, actually, I think. So, yeah, it's good for everyone to know who's looking at doing PhDs and things in the future.
Yeah.
And how about your PhD itself? How did you go about applying for that? Did you know that you wanted to do Arthurian legend, like, when you started applying, or was it something you just found? Or?
Yeah, so I really fell in love with Arthurian literature during my undergrad because I had wonderful teachers, particularly Dr. Raluca Radulescu. She's an Arthurian expert in Mallory. See where I've got this from. So yeah, I did my master's was in medieval literature, which kind of kept me still a little bit broad in scope. But there was an Arthurian module, and I decided to do my PhD. You're going to do it for 3 years. You're going to spend all day, every day thinking about this one topic. You must do it for love.
Mm.
I know people who are so bored with their PhDs and they hate their topic and they're only doing it because they got funding to do it. And I think that's really sad.
Yeah.
Because you do it every day and it must just be so soul destroying. So that's another piece of advice from your old Aunt Bex. pick something that you really love and I think everything else will fall into place.
Oh, brilliant. I think we need to get a little agony aunt section for you on the radio.
Yeah.
Good advice for students. cool, that's brilliant. I don't think I've got any more questions for you.
Okay.